Kevin Briggs is the co-author with Sam Mellinger of Guardian of the Golden Gate. Now, Kevin Briggs, welcome to Mind Talk.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Now, Kevin, when I think of Golden Gate, I think of the Golden Gate Bridge, but you're not talking about guarding the Golden Gate Bridge, or are you?
Well, I am. Guardian of the Golden Gate, but you know, there's many guardians. When I talk about this, I talk about many guardians of many Golden Gates around the world. You know, this is just one of the places where we do these type of negotiations with folks who are really, really in despair.
Well, when you say these kinds of negotiations, tell us what you're talking about. A bridge is a thing that people get in their car and they drive across or they walk across. What kind of negotiations could you possibly be doing?
Absolutely. I'm talking about negotiations where people have been depressed, for one thing, for so long, they can no longer cope with what's going on in their lives. And they come to this bridge and many others to end their life. So the negotiation part of it is myself or someone talking to those folks to try to get them back over to us to where we can give them some help.
So you really are talking about negotiating with folks to save their lives.
Well, absolutely. That's what we're trying to do.
Well, Kevin, I want to take a step back because that's quite an interesting piece of work that you're doing. And I'm sure folks are wondering how you got to this place where this is actually the work that you have done for many years. So let's start off with where you were born and what your childhood experiences were like.
Sure. Well, I was born in San Francisco, and the Golden Gate Bridge connects San Francisco to Marin County. So I was raised in Marin County, the northernmost town of that, about a half an hour or so from the bridge, a little town called Novato. And a great childhood, upper middle income, you know, everything was very good. It really was. I had a very nice childhood. And then, you know, I went into the Army right out of high school and had some twists in that. I was in Germany at the time, 1983, and I developed cancer, a testicular cancer. And they shipped me back here to California where I had my operations and chemotherapy. And after that, you know, it went well, but... And it was really tough. I lost all my hair. The chemotherapy, I was on multiple drugs that really knock you down. I went down to about 130 pounds from 175. And it really takes a toll on you. But I bounced back, recovered from that. I worked with my father. He had a printing business in San Francisco. And then worked for him for a bit. And then went into state corrections, where I worked at San Quentin for a while. And did that. And during that time I was working at San Quentin, my mother, who was just 49 years old at the time, developed cancer, lung cancer from smoking, and she actually died at age 49 at her house in front of us all.
Oh,
so really, really tough stuff.
And as I recall, wasn't there a grandparent that you lost to suicide?
There was. My father's father, a paternal grandparent, lost his life to suicide when my father was very, very young, age 3, I believe. So his father took his own life, I believe, by poisoning. And, you know, I never got to meet him. So, who knows what a relationship we could have had.
So, in fact, I mean, it sounds like in a lot of ways your childhood, as you describe it, was wonderful. I mean, growing up in a beautiful area, upper middle class, so there weren't the kind of financial challenges that many people experience. So it's good, except that, you know, things always look good from the outside looking in. The fact that your grandparent, someone who you would never meet, lost his life to suicide would clearly have had an impact on your dad. And then with the cancer that you experienced, clearly that's a sense of loss. Then your mom dying, also another sense of loss. And I'm focusing on these various huge loss experiences in your life because a lot of times when folks do find themselves close to the brink, it's the chronic sense of loss that can often lead the way for them, if you will. And we're not finished yet with the losses that you experience. There was a significant motorcycle crash in June of, I think it was 2001.
Well, correct. And, you know, I rode a motorcycle for the California Highway Patrol, and I was out on the coast. We call it West Marin, very windy roads, very rural. And I was involved in a motorcycle crash where another motorcyclist came around a corner way too fast, and he hit me head on. He just missed the car ahead of me, hit me head on. And it was determined that the speed that we were both traveling at, closing in on each other, was about 105 miles an hour.
Oh, my.
And it just knocked me out completely. I don't remember a whole lot about it, but I did get the helicopter flight to the hospital. And, you know, that concussion, that can lead to things. We know that for a fact now. We see it with a lot of football players and injuries and such. But that happened to me. And, you know, I think that took a toll. I really do. Emotionally, physically, it did. And, you know, after that, in law enforcement, unfortunately, many of us get a divorce, and that happened to me. And during that time, my ex-wife now, she's from Japan, and she wrote suicide notes to each of my boys and was looking up on the computer how to load a gun.
Oh, my.
So when I would stop by the house to see the kids, I never knew what I might be coming home to or coming back to. So all of this stuff really took a toll on me.
And working in a prison system, I can't imagine that was a walk in the park.
It's not. I did it for a job at the time. That's actually a good job. But you have to have the mentality to be there and to do that type of work. It is tough. You know, those folks are always trying to play a game on you, and it, you need to be fair and firm. You know, I've saw quite a number of officers who got hurt, who, you know, their ego got the best of them, their badge was a little too big for their britches, so to speak. You can really get hurt there. You know, these folks don't play games. So I learned a lot, though. You don't carry a weapon when you're down on the ground with the inmates, so you learn how to talk to them. You learn a lot of communication skills, how to listen better. You know, I'm not there to be a babysitter, but I'm certainly there to listen and, you know, just be part of that and help when I can. These folks, they've been suffering for years. A lot of these folks come from families and areas that are just terrible. They've grown up, you know, they're just a part of society that is not functioning well.
And we know that in so many ways, at the point that someone is in prison, for many people, the folks on the outside, they're ready to throw them away. So there's loss on top of loss. So what I hear is a lifespan that incorporated losses, your own and those around you, trauma, your own and those around you. You gotta help me understand how this impacted upon you. Just a little piece about your wife writing, your ex-wife writing suicide notes to your children. I mean, what did all this do to you?
You know, I found, and it happened through the years, in my opinion, you know, this is what happened to me. And I found myself going to work and functioning great. Everything was fine. But when I was not working, when I didn't have to go to work to support me and you know, my ex-wife and my kids, I would just sit at home. It was the very strangest thing. And I didn't realize this because it happened kind of slowly over the time. But all of these things that we've spoken about took a toll on me. And that together, it formed a depression. And I suffered a long time on this. I just didn't realize it. And I finally got diagnosed by my doctor, who knows my history, on just a regular medical exam. But I kind of sat down with him and told him what's going on. I'm functioning well at work, but at home, I'm not doing anything. I'm not really even mowing the lawn. I'm not hanging out with the kids much. I couldn't quite figure it out. So he had me take a little test, a written test, and I think I flunked it miserably because he came back in the office and said, "Kevin, was you had depression?" another thing against me. You know, I've had heart issues. I've had the 3 stents put in my heart and the cancer and all these things, and now depression. Wow. Okay. Something else to battle.
Okay, wait a second. You just threw the heart issue in there. What was going on with your heart?
Yeah, back in 2008, I believe it was, started getting some symptoms. Not numbness, as people say, or pain down my left arm, just a little bit of pain, maybe a quarter inch, running from my shoulder all the way down into my thumb. And just that, and then when I would try to sleep, it felt like acid reflux in me. So this went on for about 3 days, and I couldn't hardly sleep. I had to almost take a nap sitting up. It was really difficult. I didn't put these together as being something going on with my heart. Mm-hmm. But finally, I went to the emergency room and said, hey, something is going on. I can't sleep. This little pain down my arm. Well, the EKG was fine. Nothing showed on that. But the blood work that they took, thank God they took the blood work, came back horribly. I guess your heart exudes an enzyme when it's having an attack. And that's what was going on. So I spent the next 6 days in the hospital. They did 3 operations. Going through my femoral artery, and they put 3 stents in my heart. So that's another issue there.
So, you know, again, what we're talking about is trauma on top of trauma on top of trauma, loss on top of loss on top of loss. And so the diagnosis of depression clearly is not as, I mean, it's a surprise. It was a surprise to you. But as a clinician, I'm wondering why you weren't diagnosed earlier. But again, what you're describing is what is very often the experience of people, particularly men. You go to work, you do your thing, you're fine, and then you go home. And for many people,
right,
as long as you can get up and go to work, well, you're not depressed. You're just fine. And besides, men don't get depressed anyway, has been a myth that men have struggled with for many years.
You know, I think you're absolutely right in that. And I didn't think people would believe me when I'm traveling around and speaking to folks regarding mental illness and suicides and such. I didn't think anybody would believe me. But after I talk, I've had so many people walk up to me on a one-on-one basis and say, I was going through, or I am going through, that same thing that you went through. Wow, this really does happen to a lot of folks. And for me, it's always been men who have approached me and told me this.
Mm-hmm.
So you're right.
Well, and the fact that a man who in so many ways sort of, you know, looks like the big, strong, tall guy that, you know, many men aspire to be and look like, and that you have the courage to say, you know what, I have really been there and I have really experienced that, is hugely powerful for men. So I'm not surprised that many men come up to you and thank you for sharing your experiences. Let's talk a little bit more about the diagnosis of depression when you received it. Were you surprised? Did you accept it?
You know, I was surprised. I didn't know what this was about. You know, I knew it from other people, but it couldn't be happening to me. I was this macho guy, mm-hmm, over 200 pounds, big bodybuilder. I'm confident in what I would do. You know, it can't be happening to me. But it did. And when my doctor told me, he goes, you know, and mind you, he knows my history and what we've spoken about here. He goes, Kevin, you have depression. He goes, how do you feel about that? I remember giggling a little bit. I go, how do you think I feel about this? Look at my history, and now I have depression? Come on. I'm a nightmare here.
That's an interesting question to ask.
Yes. So, you know, we talked about it for a while. He did put me on some medication, which I always tell folks, it was for me. It's not for everybody. There's a lot of different therapies and things out there. So for me, it has helped. We're still working on it. I think we'll be working on it the rest of my life probably. But it has helped me.
Well, let's talk about medication for a moment. I'm glad you bring that up because so many people are really resistant to the idea of taking medication. And for some people, medication is indicated, certainly at least a try is indicated, and is often life-changing and very, very helpful. Did you have any initial resistance to taking medication for depression?
You know, I didn't. When my doctor told me this, and I've been with him for years, you know, I put my faith and my trust in doctors, really, I do. So I said, all right, let's give this a try because I don't want to feel as I am right now. So if this can help me, then let's give it a shot. I don't like it. I don't like being that, you know, diagnosed with depression. It sounded like a weakness. Now, of course, I know different.
Mm-hmm.
But it's something, let's live with it. Let's deal with it. And, you know, hopefully have a better existence because of it. This medication that he's talking about.
I want to get sort of a closer look at behaviorally what was going on for you with your depression. You would go to work. You would function at work. Nobody would know. When you went home, what would you do once you hit your front door?
Once I hit the front door, I would do only the minimum needed that I would have to do. You know, if I had to pick the kids up from something or take them somewhere, then I would do it. If I didn't have to do anything, I would basically sit on the couch and watch TV. If I was off for 3 days and I didn't have to do anything, I would be there for the better part of 3 days. I just didn't have it in me to go outside. I had no desire to go out and do things. It's very, very strange.
So it's not that you, I don't hear that you were crying. I don't hear that you were saying I'm sad. There was an absence of emotional connection, it sounds like, for you. That's the way you experienced it.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I wasn't crying. I didn't understand what was going on with me, but I thought I would just snap out of it at some point, which I didn't.
So you
went on for quite some time.
So you didn't really have any energy. You didn't want to talk to people. You didn't want to hang. So there was a change in your daily sort of living activities. There was a change in your social routine. What about your eating and your sleeping?
My sleeping has been poor for many, many years. I was just, here's another one. I was just diagnosed just a couple of months ago with sleep apnea.
Okay.
I believe when I did the test for it, something in the area of 25 times an hour, there was no movement in my breathing for 10 seconds or more.
Hmm.
So quite a bit. So now I have that APAP machine.
Okay. Is it helping?
I think so. It takes some time to get used to, I got to tell you.
Yeah.
It's a little rough. I look like a fighter pilot or something at night wearing this mask on.
But I do hear that it absolutely helps. Yeah. All right. So, again, I just want folks to be clear that depression can show up in different ways for different people. And for you, there was nothing overt. There was no talk of anything. There was just a significant change in how you experienced your life. And thank goodness your doctor decided to dig deeper. A lot of times men certainly will find that they're talking to their primary care about something else, and that's when this information comes out.
Right. And like you said, with me, you know, I didn't realize it, and here I am talking to folks about this all the time. For me, it was pretty hideous, and it took a good toll on my life. You know, it was hidden there that I didn't realize it. And, you know, to me, it was kind of subtle, but it affected me greatly.
Absolutely.
So it was tough.
Kevin Briggs, author of Guardian of the Golden Gate, Protecting the Line Between Hope and Despair. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue with Kevin Briggs. So, folks, don't go away. This is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Men's Monday here on Mind Talk. Kevin, we were talking about your ex-wife who was threatening suicide and trying to figure out how best to accomplish that. What happened with your ex-wife and your children?
Well, you know, I found these two notes that she had written to the boys, these suicide notes, and also on the computer where she was looking up how to load a gun. So I had to sit down and talk with her. I said, wow, this is really going on. There's not a high divorce rate in Japan, and she is from Japan. You know, very unfortunate that this occurred, that this divorce occurred. She's doing much better now. But, I mean, as most people, it really, really hit her hard. It took a heavy toll on us. It takes a toll on everybody, sure. Divorces. You know, you hear the word almost daily, divorce, divorce, divorce. But when it's happening to you and going through it, whew, it's tough.
It's totally different really when it's you.
Yes. Yes, it really is. So, you know, we sat down and I just talked with her for the longest amount of time and tried to help her out the best that I could. And I really recommended going to a doctor and getting some therapy, which she finally did. So I think that helped out tremendously.
And what was the impact of this on your boys?
Oh, boy, really hit them hard. Right now, my boys are 12 and 14. And my 14-year-old, I had not discussed this divorce with him. And last year, I'm going to tell you a story here, if that's okay.
That's perfectly fine.
Okay. Last year, I was coming back from one of my trips. I landed at San Francisco Airport. I turned on my cell phone, and there's a call from my youngest, little Travis. And I thought it would be, hey, Dad, welcome home. Stop by our house on the way up so we can see you. But it wasn't. It was little Travis, and he goes, Dad, you need to get here quick. Kevin Jr., broke an iPad. He's in the backyard, and he says he's going to kill himself. So I started working my way up to the house. It's about an hour drive, and as I'm doing this, Travis is sending me a couple of texts, and one of them was, Dad, you need to get here quick, but when you do, be nice and say nice things to Kevin, with Kevin Jr. I thought that was kind of neat. So I get to the house, and my sister lives in the house with my ex-wife and my two boys. So there is little Travis, my ex-wife, my sister, and then Kevin Jr. is in the backyard, and he's just pacing. It's dark out. He's just in the darkness, no lights at all. I watch him for just a little bit. He's just pacing back and forth. And then I go out there, and I've always called him baby boy, which he doesn't like, but I do. And I put my hand on his shoulder, and I go, hey, baby boy, what's going on? And he just breaks down crying. I've never seen him cry like this. So we go sit in the backyard in the darkness for quite some time and talk about what is going on in his life. The biggest thing I feel was, I had not discussed my divorce with him. I was ashamed of it and all sorts of things about it. He thought he was the cause of the divorce, which was absolutely wrong. But in his little mind, he thought he did this.
And that's so common with children.
I learned that the hard way.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And also, he was 13 at the time. Some of his acquaintances at school started using marijuana, you know, and they were asking him about it, and he wanted nothing to do with it. He's a big-time soccer player. Traveling all over. We just got back from Las Vegas this week where he was competing in a tournament. And also, I didn't feel I was putting pressure on him at school to get good grades, but he says I was. And he's a 3.7, I believe, GPA.
Wow.
You know, so if he says I was, you know what? I am. I was putting pressure on him. So we decided to go see a clinician. And on the day of the appointment, I take him and I ask him, do you want me in the room with you? I've never done this before. And he goes, yes, Dad, I want you in the room with me. I asked the clinician, would you like me in the room? And he says, yes, sir, why don't you come in? And before this starts, I explained to the clinician what I did for my job and what I do now in case there was some suicide ideation there. So when we go into the room, he starts talking to little Kevin, asking him basic questions and how's his home life and getting into what he likes and dislikes about each person and how he feels it could be better. And then he digs into him a little more, and he asks him, have you ever hurt yourself on purpose? And I knew exactly what he was asking. And little Kevin puts his left hand wrist up, and like he pokes it with his right hand, like he stabs himself in the wrist. And that hit me really, really hard. I will never forget this. That, like he cut himself. This non-surgical self-injury, this non-suicidal self-injury that we know is, to me, it's a cry for help.
Absolutely.
People, when they're in such emotional pain, they cut themselves, and it releases those endorphins to mask that pain. And time again, they have to continually do this. And they're very ashamed by this. So they wear long sweaters and long pants to cover themselves up. I had to turn my face and look away. I was tearing up. I could still, to this day, and this just happened last year, and it's hard to talk about. I couldn't believe this is happening at home. So then he went a little further, and he asked a question like this, the clinician. He goes, well, you're not going to commit suicide, are you? I'm like, wow, that was a really crappy way of asking that question. And of course, little Kevin says no, because you answered it for him. It was terrible. And then the clinician looks over at me, and he goes, did I cover all the bases? Because of what I had told him, I advised him before. I'm like, wow, okay, you have all these degrees all over, and you're asking me if you covered the bases. It was really bad. It was a bad scene all around. So we got through that, and I spoke with the gentleman afterwards, and I said, hey, you know, I don't have the diplomas or degrees you have, but I have some training in this, and I've been through a lot of training, actually. And this is kind of how we ask that question. You know, have you been having thoughts of killing yourself? I believe is a much better way, because then they have to answer it,
right?
You know, hopefully, truthfully.
Right.
But to come up from an adult to a little kid and say, you're not going to do that, are you? Of course they're going to say no. You answered it for him.
Right.
So he was the clinician was quite embarrassed. Luckily, he did not have an ego. And, you know, we talked about it, and we stayed with him. And little Kevin is doing much, much better now. So I learned a lot from that. And, you know, I learned a lot about myself. But little Kevin, it could have cost me my little boy, you know. And I knew these type of things. I just didn't think it would happen in my family. It goes on for people all over. But you know, those in the healthcare field, first responders, firemen and cops and such, many, many times we give, and we don't realize what's happening to ourselves and our family. And this is exactly what took place.
That's very true. And, you know, one of the things that I'd like to underscore about the story that you just shared with us, and I thank you for that, because I know that was hard to experience then and hard to share now, but the idea of actually saying to the clinician what your evaluation was of what was going on, a lot of times parents won't do that. Clients won't do that, and it's really important. If you've got something going on in your head that's a question about what just happened in that session, you absolutely need to say something about it. So I'm pleased that you shared that part of the story as well.
And you know, I debated it quickly in my mind as all this was going on, like, should I do this? But it hurt me. It really did. And I know if he's doing this to my little boy, it's happening to many people. And here's what I found out. A 2013 study out of the Washington State University, is 50% of psychologists, 25% of social workers, and just 6% of counselors had training in suicide risk assessment. I was amazed by that.
Yeah.
So, and he fell into that category. I thought this is what they did. This is, you know, one of the top things. You need to find this out. This is huge.
Kinda, yeah. The experience of having depression in your own life, personally, and certainly in your grandfather's life, and it's reasonable to assume that there was some depression in your dad's experience as well, just because of the impact of loss of a parent to suicide on a child. So it was really very much throughout your family. And here you are today, and I want to sort of come up to what you're doing, what you were doing on the bridge that actually occasioned this book, sort of taking a bath almost in helping people in the pain that people experience that takes them to the edge, where they want to seek out a permanent solution to what they see as a permanent problem, even though it likely is not. How did you get from doing all of this work to doing the work that you do now? Why try to help people save themselves?
You know, I and a very easy answer and basic answer is, when I see someone over that rail, and when they look at me, to see the look in their eyes, I mean, to anybody who has any sort of compassion, you would want to help. And for me wanting to work down there on that bridge, this is what I need to do. I need to get some training. When I look in those folks' eyes and you can see the despair, most of the time they want to live, but they don't think they can. It's like they're forced to jump off of this bridge. Their coping mechanisms are gone. I'll tell you 99% of the time, if they were prescribed a medication for a mental illness, they've stopped it a month or so prior. And that's a huge one. I tell folks, don't stop your medication if it's prescribed to you. You know, maybe you need to change it. Maybe it is working. Maybe it's not. But don't just stop it without telling them. The look in their eyes is really something. So, you know, as someone who had depression and just these things growing up that affected me, it was a duty for me. It was a calling, I guess. It was something I was very, very interested in, because I thought, what if it was me over that rail? Who would I want contacting me? What if it was my boy over that rail or someone that I knew? Who would I want contacting them? So, and that's how many officers and first responders feel. That, you know, this, they want to do the best that they can, so they want the training around it.
Does it take a toll? Did it take a toll on you personally?
I would say yes. I've had a number of people come up and tell me, you need to go talk about these different things that have happened in your life. I have not yet. To be honest with you, I plan to. I'm just waiting for some of these. I'm still doing a lot of traveling and speaking, but come December more or later on in the year, then I plan to. But I think I can still function, me personally. It takes a toll. It really does. It's not an everyday thing that I see these people's faces, but they do come in. And, you know, the ones that I have lost, you still wonder. You still dwell on it at times. What could I have done differently to change that? And maybe deep down, I know, you know, a lot of these folks come up here. This is the end point. It's very, very tough to get them back over the rail. So, you know, you are going to lose some if you're in this line of work. The majority of folks that I talk to over the rail that we able to get to, they do come back over, and we are able to at least get them to a local hospital. But we do lose some, and those haunt you forever, at least in my view, with me.
You talk in your book about someone named Jason, and you say that it was clear to you that Jason had his mind made up. Tell us about Jason.
Right. And this was July 22nd of 2013. We received a call of a man over the rail. And when you go over that 4-foot pedestrian rail on the bridge, Golden Gate Bridge, there's like an I-beam on the other side of that. And that's where many folks stand, while they're contemplating whether to take their life or not. Well, Jason was over the rail in the middle of the bridge. And we got the call. I was the on-duty sergeant, the on-duty supervisor. I responded down there on my motorcycle. The officers were all busy with different details at the time, so I was the first EHP officer there, but there was already a bridge. The bridge has security guards around it, and there was already a security guard from the bridge talking to Jason, and this guy was really, really good. He was an older gentleman that really had compassion and was good at talking to people, so we kind of traded off for the most part talking with Jason. Jason was from New Jersey and had flown out to the bridge 3 times, this being his 3rd time, to attempt suicide. I asked him at one point, Jason, why this bridge? And his answer to me was, it'll get the job done. That's all that he said.
That's chilling.
But to me, he was brilliant, Jason. It really was. He was eloquent in his talk, and, you know, the things he would answer. He didn't get into a lot of different things, but he did suffer from depression. He didn't like the medication that he'd been taking. A number of things were going on in his life that just weren't right, and this has been going on for a long time. But Jason was a poet, a writer, and just, you can tell just by looking at him and listening to him, that he was an amazing young man. At one point, I remember the Golden Gate Bridge security officer said, Jason, you should be over on this side where we are talking to folks over the rail. That's how amazing he was. And some folks I talk to about this story, and they go, if he's so amazing, what's he doing over there? Well, you know, that's, I don't like that, really. That's mental illness. That's what happens. It can happen to any of us.
Exactly.
It really can. So at one point, after about an hour talking with Jason, he asked us if we knew the story of Pandora's Box. And we said we did. I tell folks, if you don't recall it, it's Greek mythology. Zeus created Pandora and sent her down to Earth with a box and said under no circumstances ever, ever open this box. Well, of course, one day she does. And out comes all sorts of plagues and evils and sorrows against man. And the only good thing in that box is hope. Well, Jason comes back and he goes, when I open that box, hope is the greatest evil. That's how profound he was. And he stumped me with this one. I'd never heard that before. It was amazing. I just, wow, okay, this guy's really a deep thinker. And I couldn't think of something to say. He got me good. I was like, wow. So as I was standing there, we were contemplating how to go out on this. Jason, he was sitting on this I-beam, and he kind of stiffened up his back, and I saw just a single tear come down of his right eye, right side, fall down his cheek, and he just leaned to his right, and he was gone. He took his life. So they say don't watch. I've been taught to not watch the bodies fall because that's what sticks in your head. But of course I do. Me personally, a few reasons. One, to me it's a failure. I watch this failure to completeness. But also I want to mark the body. When that body hits, the waters down there are very, very treacherous. Mm-hmm. And we lose a number of people. So when this happened and Jason hit, there's a huge splash. You can hear it, even though it's 220 feet down. You can hear this. And I'm sorry if I'm going too deep into this, but it's tough. People need to realize this.
Absolutely.
And the Golden Gate Bridge guy was tearing up, and I was like, oh, my God. I thought we were kind of in the middle of this negotiation, so to speak. Sometimes you can tell people are going to go, but you still do your job the best that you can.
Of course.
Jason was kind of on the board, but he had that determined look kind of on his face, too. So the Coast Guard, we call them out whenever these things occur, and they're standing by in case an individual does jump. So they came over and picked up Jason's body and took him back. And what we do and what I tell negotiators when I teach at conferences is if you're handling one of these cases and that person jumps or shoots himself, whatever they do, with the Highway Patrol, we're done. We've learned that we do not go down to the Coast Guard station where the body is and handle it. Whoever was dealing with that individual when they were alive, they're done. They're like a witness now. Okay. Another officer will go down and take care of that because you don't want to go down and see what is, in my opinion, a failure.
Well,
so another
and
officer
pain.
Takes over.
And also just the pain of that person's life gone.
Right, right. And I think that really helps us out, is not seeing that. So, you know, that occurred. And if I have a few more minutes, I can tell you what continued after this. So I was standing there, we're trying to take all this in. A gentleman, a citizen, comes running up to me, and he's an officer. There's a body in the water. And I was pretty emotional and pretty annoyed by that statement. You know, what the hell do you think I've been doing for an hour? He goes, no, another one. So we were in the middle of the bridge. Up at the North Tower, another gentleman had jumped at the same time we were speaking with Jason.
Oh, no.
That no one had contacted him. Maybe he was just on the sidewalk and didn't even go over the rail to stand on what we call the cord, that I-beam. He may have just jumped from the sidewalk. So we responded up there, and I saw the body in the water. What happened really was, as that body floated into the bay, the Coast Guard was not able to respond. They were still dealing with Jason. A huge container ship came by and struck that body, and it was never to be found.
Oh, my.
And even prior to this, an hour and a half prior to this, we had another person jump off of this bridge. So that's three in that one day. Now, that's unusual, but it starts with the officers being affected, and then it just spiderwebs out to the families and friends. You know, that pain, the pain that those folks were in that jumped is transferred to many, many, many people.
Absolutely. Kevin, I we're going to take a break, but I have to thank you for the work that you do, and I do encourage you to talk more, because you've been through a great deal yourself. But when we come back, I'd like to pick up with perhaps a success story, and you wound up on the Steve Harvey Show. So
correct.
We're going to have to figure out how you got from the Golden Gate Bridge to the Steve Harvey Show. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. I'm having a conversation with Kevin Briggs, who is the author of Guardian of the Golden Gate. Protecting the Line Between Hope and Despair. We'll be back in just a minute. Experiences that you've had, some of them have been very painful and have not ended in ways that you would have hoped. Some of them have been extraordinarily successful. Tell us how you found yourself on the stage with Steve Harvey, who, as many people know, is a talk show host. And what was some of the difficulty that you had with actually getting to that stage? I think work was impacting on that trip.
Right. Well, I was with Kevin Berthia, an African-American man who came to the bridge and to jump off it. He had a very, very rough time in his young life. I believe he was 22 at the time. And he had suffered for years from mental illness. He was on medication, but had actually stopped it, like we spoke about earlier. He had a newborn child who was born 2 months premature, and he was racking up over $200,000 in medical bills. He had just lost his job. He was adopted. His birth mother didn't want anything to do with him. His adopted parents divorced when he was around 11 or so, and he thought he was the cause of that, something like I had run into. So all of this hit him just way too hard. He didn't know how to deal with it, so he wound up on the bridge over that rail, and I spoke with him for 90 minutes. But for 90 minutes, I spoke for maybe 4 or 5 of those minutes. Kevin was looking for somebody to listen to him. In his mind, he was there to jump that day. I just happened to respond down and catch his attention. And it was, I introduced myself and say, "Hi, I'm Kevin. Can I come up and speak with you?" And he wanted nothing to do with me. He said, "Stay away. If you come one step closer, I'm jumping." And he was very serious. There was no games with him. But he did allow me after 15, 20 minutes to come up and speak with him. And what I do, what I have found out is better, is to get below those folks, to have them looking down at me. If anyone's seen that picture, you see there's a rail and he's standing below it and I'm looking down upon him. Okay. But I can tell you that was near the point to where he came back over. I was going to help him. The majority of the time, I want to get, either whether I have to kneel down or whatever else, I want them looking down at me. It's very empowering. So that's what I did.
Okay.
And he spoke about all these things going on with him. And he decided that day to come back over that rail and give life another chance. And he did. I helped him back over, you know, congratulated him. So I did not hear from him for some years. And then I was asked by the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention to come out and receive an award in New York. And they asked me if there's anybody that I had dealt with who was a survivor. And I had a note from Kevin's mother. She had written me just a little bit after this occurrence with Kevin. So I contacted her. I don't want to contact the folks who I've dealt with. I don't think it's right. And I don't want to be a trigger for something else happening with them. But I did contact his mother. And she immediately got a hold of Kevin, and he wanted to meet me. It was really, really neat. But we did not meet until we were in New York, the first time where we met together after some years. And it was really, really cool to finally meet. And he spoke on stage, and it was very, very neat for him to do this. But after that, the Steve Harvey Show found out about this and asked us both to come on. And I didn't realize he was there. I wasn't putting two and two together. But they brought me out on stage, and Steve Harvey was talking to me. And Kevin is sitting in the audience, and he led up to this. It was pretty funny. So he brought Kevin down, and they presented me with a jacket, Harvey's Heroes. It was a really, really neat event.
It sounds wonderful. And people at your job, they were just loving this, right?
The majority of them. I can tell you, though, there's some that were jealous. And the funny part about this is that never, ever, ever in my talks around, you know, the United States, wherever I was going, I never talked about, this is not the Kevin Briggs Show. I talked about what we did on the Golden Gate Bridge. the other people who do this, there's a number of others who do this same type of work that I do, and there's folks all around the world. When I was started talking about this, I made a vow that this is about the folks I'm talking to or about. This is not the Kevin Briggs Show. Right. It's out there to help others. But of course, with every job or when somebody has what I might call success, there's those who are jealous. Why isn't it me out there doing it? Why does it have to be you? I don't know. I didn't ask for all these interviews. They came to me. But if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this right. And I'm going to represent all the people who do this type of work. And that's how I feel about it.
And may I say that I believe that you represent them quite well. You talk in your book about something called the release model, R-E-L-E-A-S-E. And you're quick to say that it's not clinically proven, but that it's worked.
Right, right. And it's an acronym for recognize, engage, listen, empathy, accept, support, and encourage. And I think it's just an easier way for folks, if they were going to have that courageous conversation, to talk about if someone may be thinking about losing their life to suicide, how that individual who's going to do the talking can feel better about confronting someone. And the person they're talking to can open up. Because what you're asking them to do is to release their emotions and open up to you to find out what's really going on with them. So I developed this program to help folks so they feel more comfortable in doing this.
Now, I'm pretty sure that you and I are both aware of the fact that it's almost human nature. If you run across someone who is about to do something that you think is harmful to them, what you're going to say is, you can't do that. Don't do that. And try to convince them about how wonderful the world is. In your experience, does that work?
Most of the time, not. And when I first started doing this type of work, I said about everything wrong you could. Things like, well, it'll get better. I understand. Don't do this. How could you hurt your family? All these things that you really aren't supposed to say, or, you know, you're just emotional right now. It'll get a lot better. Give it some time. Well, these things that, as not a trained clinician, a psychiatrist, psychologist, and such, I don't know things are going to get better. You know, or things like calm down. When somebody is very high emotional, you know, telling them to calm down just just jacks them up even further. So we stay away from this. But I learned these over time. And I would always, even to the day I retired, would ask folks who came back over that rail, I would ask them, what did I do that helped them, that helped that incident, and what did I do that they felt wasn't right? So I learned a lot about, you can't have an ego in this type of field, I believe. Learn each and every time.
What were some of the things that folks told you helped them of what you said or did when you encountered them?
Many times, just being there for them, letting them talk about it and not judging them. When they would say, I was a drug user for years, I'm homeless, I stole things, I did this. Not judging them. Say, wow, that must be really tough. You know, just to be there for them instead of, I think a lot of times people, wow, why did you do that? You know, why is something that I try not to say much.
Okay.
Because that kind of places blame. You know, why are you here? Why did you do that? No, just to try and understand. And I didn't want to lie to them or promise them anything. You know, I wouldn't say, hey, come back over and we'll go for a great steak dinner. Nope, not going to do it. Because if this happens again, the officer that has to deal with that individual is not going to be able to do it that well. This person's not going to trust them. So, and not telling them things will get better. I don't know that. That's a false promise.
Right. So it's really important to be honest, to be open, to be non-judgmental, and listen.
You're exactly right. And you know this better than I do, but that's what I would try to do. And maybe focus on a certain number of things. If they had children, what do you think your children would think about this? Something like that. If they were responsible for things, the responsibilities. Wow. And sometimes they don't understand. They don't get it because when you're over that rail, you know, sometimes it's been years of built up depression and different things that have happened in their lives that now they're there and they're not thinking clearly. I mean, you know, if you think about it, who would be thinking clearly over that rail? contemplating what might be your last few moments on Earth. It's very, very tough.
Absolutely. There are people who do the work that you do and very quickly stop, I would think. Do you find that? Do you find that there's a great deal of burnout in your line of work?
You know, it's with me, I have seen either folks like to do this type of work out of necessity. We'd rather not do it, but we feel it's important, so we do it. And there's folks who don't like this type of work. I know officers who don't want to deal with folks over the rail, so they don't work down on the bridge. You know, they will work in a different area because they don't feel they could handle it, they could do it properly. We all have things that we like. In law enforcement, we have folks that have the drug dogs and they do that bit, or you know, they're big into search and seizure things. And negotiations and doing this type of work was what I found that I really liked. So I studied it and I was able to get training, and it was a passion for me. So if you don't like doing it, or you feel that maybe you can't handle it if you lose someone, then, you know, there's other things that you can do.
Is it a fair statement to say that any person, any officer, any law enforcement person who's working any bridge needs to have this kind of training in the event of?
You know, I would say any law enforcement officer should have this sort of training.
Okay.
At least the basic training is what I'm, because I had none. And to this day, in the Highway Patrol, in my opinion, they're still not trained that well.
Okay.
And, you know, with more and more people in the world, there's more and more mental illness. You're going to encounter these types of cases, whether it's on a bridge, a building, you know, a barricaded subject, someone in a car with a gun to their head. I mean, you're going to encounter this type of stuff. Maybe it's not even to that extent, but you will encounter someone having difficulty because of mental illness. And if we could have just some basic training, that would really help us out to develop those active listening skills.
Is there anything that you would say could be useful in terms of making the bridges more secure? I mean, the numbers of people who attempt to kill themselves by virtue of jumping off a bridge is fairly staggering.
It is. It is. And I actually had dinner with a guy named Donald McDonald, and he was the architect for the bridge barrier that's going to go up on the Golden Gate Bridge in just a couple of years. And he developed this system that's going to take place on there. And it's fascinating. And he's a fascinating man. It was really neat to speak with him. I believe in suicide barriers. I really do. Now, that doesn't mean that individual will go and do something, you know, somewhere else. I've heard some different things that, well, if you take away that means they won't commit suicide, so to speak. Be honest with you, I don't know if I agree with that. I think maybe they won't come up on the bridge, but if they really want to lose their life, they're going to get a different way. At least during that time, they won't.
What is a suicide barrier?
This is something that's going to, on this particular bridge, it's going to be an apparatus that's about 20 feet below the roadway, and it extends about 20 feet out from the bridge. So it's like, the way I was told, it's like metal wires that go out, protruding away from the bridge. And if someone jumps, they get caught in these wires, and it kind of goes all around them like a spider web. So then we'll have to have a fire department come and get those folks out. So it'd be very difficult to jump 20 feet out. It really would. So this is going to be a huge deterrent. I think the numbers from folks who jump off the bridge are going to really diminish.
All right, so just describe that for us once again. It's 20 feet out, and it's attached.
Right.
It's attached to the bridge.
Correct. And it's about 20 feet down. And they made this so it's still pleasing to the eye on the bridge. It's not obstructing views so much, because that was a huge one with you know, most folks in the Bay Area or around the world that want to come and they want to look straight down and see that water. So this is going to be really, really neat. As far as the year I retired, we lost close to 60 folks from that bridge. Mm. Confirmed. And this is going to really take those numbers down. But I think if someone decides to jump, very few of us can jump 20 feet out. It just doesn't happen. Right. So they will fall, they'll get into this, and these wires that are running across up and down it will go around and encapsulate this individual, making it very difficult for them to move. And I believe this is divided into a bunch of sections. So that section will have to be removed from the bridge, and I'm sure they'll have ones that are standing by to put back in place here.
I see. Okay.
And then, you know, that person will be taken to one of the local hospitals.
Kevin, as we wrap up our conversation today, I'm going to put you on the spot. For those who are listening, if they are aware of someone or themselves have given thought to ending their own lives, any guidance, any wisdom you'd like to share?
Yes. Well, I would say have that courageous conversation. If you can't, have somebody else do it. I would say, me personally, do it on a one-on-one, not in a coffee shop, in a restaurant, somewhere where that person that you're talking to can feel, they can let go of their emotions. So just do this on a one-on-one. It's not an intervention, so to speak, you know, where you're having five people talking to one person. You're asking this person to break down. So maybe if you can't do it, have somebody do it. Because look at the regret if we don't do that and that person loses their life because you didn't have the courage to do that. It takes a lot of courage to go up and build that rapport with someone for, you know, several minutes or so and then ask them, have you been having thoughts of losing your life or committing suicide? But when we talk about folks, hey, I have seen this, 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 and this, or I've heard about these things going on, I'm worried about you. Let's talk about what's going on in your life.
And, you know, Kevin, for so many people, when they actually think about the fact or the possibility of suicide, extreme depression, it frightens them into their own sort of space of silence. And what you're saying is, if you don't feel like you can have the conversation, find somebody who can, but let's not be silent around this issue.
That's exactly what I'm saying. Because we're losing people. We're losing over 41,000 folks a year just, you know, in the United States to suicide. It's bigger than traffic accidents, fatalities. And I was a traffic cop, and we're losing, you know, roughly 32,000 folks a year to traffic accidents. But look at the amount of money that's put into analog brakes and all, you know, DUIs and all these different things.
Right.
Look at the amount of money that's placed on mental illness.
It's true.
Very, very little as comparative. So we have a lot of work to do. So it needs to start with us.
Well, Kevin, I have to thank you for the work that you have done and for the work that you continue to do. And I certainly thank you for the Guardian of the Golden Gate, protecting the line between hope and despair. That's a pretty spiffy picture of you there on the front with the Golden Gate Bridge behind you. Thank you very much, Kevin.
Well, thank you very much. And folks, I would like to end it, you know, thank you for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
And folks, thank you for joining me on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications, and it is available to you on demand 24/7 by going to myndtalk.org, or you can simply go to iTunes and download the Mind Talk app. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, you can send an email to pamela@mindtalk.org. That is a confidential email address. Only I will see it. So again, that's pamela@myndtalk.org. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, well, it's unacceptable. Take care.